Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, more local reaction to Governor Hochul's proposed cell phone ban for schools in New York. We speak with Monticello Central School District Superintendent Dr. Matthew Evans about the district's policies on the cell phone ban, its stance on potential immigration raids at the school, and the possible dismantling of the U.S. Department of Education. Equine Therapy, Fair Hill Therapeutic Riding Center in Waymart, Pennsylvania, is enhancing lives through equine-assisted services. We'll learn more about how they're bridging the gap between humans and horses in a relationship that fosters excitement, enthusiasm, and a sense of achievement. Plus a book giveaway in Liberty for elementary school children and a writing workshop for all levels. All coming up, but first the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump plans to announce more tariffs this afternoon. NPR Scott Horsley reports the move could complicate efforts to combat inflation.
President Trump wants to impose what he calls reciprocal tariffs, matching the import taxes that other countries charge on U.S. exports. Trump insists the move would give a boost to domestic manufacturers. It also has the potential to raise prices. The Labor Department's newest report says wholesale prices are climbing even faster than retail prices. Wholesale prices in January were up 3.5% from a year ago. Consumer prices are up 3% over the last 12 months. Stock in Deere & Company has lost a little green after the farm equipment maker warned of slowing sales in North America. U.S. farmers get more than 20% of their income from exports, and they're often a high-profile target in any trade war. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump is welcoming India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi to the White House today. One key issue they're expected to talk about is tariffs. A federal judge has declined to block the Trump administration's plans to offer deferred resignations to federal workers. The offer would allow workers to resign but get paid through September. Labor unions for the federal workers had sued, but the judge said the unions did not have standing to file the lawsuit. The decision allows the program to continue, but NPR's Andrea Hsu reports the deferred resignation offer may already be over.
The Office of Personnel Management sent emails out last night telling employees as of 7:20 p.m. the offer was closed, meaning they're not accepting more resignations, so presumably they start processing them. But an important point is that the judge did not address the legality of the program in his ruling, and unions have said this is a setback but not the end of the fight. They're exploring other options.
NPR's Andrea Hsu reporting. The ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza appears to be back on track after a few days of uncertainty. Earlier this week, Hamas said it would delay Saturday's scheduled release of three Israeli hostages. Hamas had accused Israel of violating the agreement. Israel denied it. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has more from Tel Aviv.
Mediators have been hard at work after Israel threatened to return to war if the hostages weren't released on time. Now, signals from all sides seem to suggest the disagreement has been solved. Mahmoud Mardawi, a senior Hamas leader, told NPR Hamas wants the agreement to be implemented in full. We are fully and truly committed to every term of it, as long as Israel is, he said. An Egyptian official with knowledge of the talks, speaking on the condition of anonymity because they are not authorized to speak to the media, told NPR there has been an agreement. Another official with the details, also not authorized to speak publicly, confirmed that, saying the sides have reached an understanding on the main points. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The full Senate is supposed to hold a confirmation vote today on Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s nomination to be Health and Human Services Secretary. This comes as a Senate committee will hold a confirmation hearing today for Education Secretary nominee Linda McMahon. She led World Wrestling Entertainment for years. The World Health Organization says the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has stopped sharing almost all data on influenza. President Trump has pulled the U.S. out of the WHO. NPR's Gabriella Emanuel reports this comes at a time when bird flu is circulating in the U.S. and seasonal flu levels are high.
For decades, the U.S. has shared influenza data through the WHO flu reporting system. Then, in late January, the WHO says the U.S. stopped uploading their data. That's right around the same time that President Trump ordered CDC officials to stop communicating with WHO officials. Maria Van Kerkhove is with the WHO.
We have not had direct communication with CDC related to influenza. We are communicating with them, but we haven't heard anything back.
Among other things, the WHO relies on flu data about which strains are circulating. That helps them tailor the flu vaccine to the current situation. Gabriela Emanuel, NPR News.
The European Climate Service, Copernicus, says last month was the hottest January on record. The agency says globally the Earth was 0.09 degrees Celsius warmer than the last hottest January. Officials say the heat is due to global warming. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. We've told you about that proposed cell phone ban for New York students. Most local school districts in New York are holding off on taking action regarding Governor Kathy Hochul's proposed cell phone ban, awaiting more guidance from the state. If the law is passed by the state legislature in the coming weeks, districts will be required to create specific plans to restrict smartphone use throughout the entire school day. While many school districts already have cell phone policies in place, such as asking students to put their phones away during certain times, few are as strict as the governor's proposal. Her legislation mandates no phone access from the first bell until the final bell. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio spoke with Monticello Central School District Superintendent Dr. Matthew Evans about the district's policies on the cell phone ban, and they also touched on the district's stance on potential immigration raids at the school and the possible dismantling of the U.S. Department of Education.
It doesn't come as a surprise. I believe the governor had gone on what she called a listening tour last year. Going to different communities, gauging public sentiment around a possible ban. And I think certainly her rationale for the ban is very well-founded. There's a lot of research that points to the detriment that smartphones in particular and social media cause for teenagers and adolescents and the distraction that they serve in schools. That it was included in her budget proposal was by no means a surprise.
Are there any cell phone restrictions within Monticello now?
Yes. So I guess we have what could probably be called a soft ban, which is basically at the elementary level, phones really are not permitted. However, if a student has one and it's put away and concealed, there's nobody checking for those. At the secondary schools, they are not allowed to be out or on, or in other words, they have to be silenced during class times. During the school day, during academic periods, they are not to be accessed, they're not to be out, they're not to be on. However, students may access them during passing times and during lunchtime and while on the bus to and from school. So that's the current state in Monticello. We have, however, convened a cell phone committee, an ad hoc cell phone committee that looked at this very same subject over the past year. And that committee and the Board of Education and administration are strongly considering our own ban that would be consistent with what the governor is calling for. I think right now we're waiting to see how the governor's proposal ends up. But we are right now tracking towards a hard ban in all of our schools starting in the fall.
Mm. And how do you think a policy like that would impact the students in Monticello?
I think what I have been able to read in different articles and hear from colleagues who have done such a ban in their schools, there's some initial pushback and resistance, not only from parents, but also parents and caregivers. But as the policy becomes more and more routine, it gains a lot more acceptance and understanding. And I would say even some of the student members on our cell phone committee, the initial reaction was, no, we need these cell phones. We need to communicate with our families and our friends and so forth. But as they began to dig deeper into the research on this, and as we've trialed the soft band this year, they became more understanding of it and in fact have supported a hard ban as well. I think there's going to be some initial pushback and resistance. There's going to be some challenges in enforcement, as there is in any rule that we have in our school system. However, I think ultimately it is in the better interest of students. And I think students, staff, and families will come around to understand it and appreciate it.
You answered my next question I had for you was, have you heard any feedback from parents or staff about the idea of a cell phone ban? And it seems like you said you had this committee already formed, so you are getting some feedback.
I call that minimal because it is right now just a committee and kind of those staff and families that are either in that committee or around it. But we would certainly later in the spring, I think once the budget is set and the governor's, we know one way or the other way that the way the state is going, then we'll be able to work with our community and getting information out about what our next steps are.
Yeah, absolutely. Just moving on to some more national news that we had here. There's been nationally some immigration raids happening due to the current administration. I just want to see, has the district provided any sort of specific guidance to staff regarding how they should respond if immigration enforcement actions occur near or within the school?
Absolutely. We jumped on this right away back in January when it came through in an executive order. And, you know, working with our legal counsel, we've provided our building administrators with directions and instructions on how to respond in the event of any type of immigration enforcement action were to happen in our schools. And that could be as slight as a request for student records or as dramatic as a possible deportation order. And I can confidently say that neither of those or anything else has happened over the last month relative to immigration action in our schools. Our administrators are fully prepared and versed on how to go about responding to those types of queries. They've shared that with their stakeholders, staff members, and some of the immigrant families that we serve. And I know that our principals and staff, including teachers, are in contact with immigrant families about what those guidelines are and how we would respond in those scenarios.
Okay. So it could get a little more specific as far as just like a scenario of ICE shows up to the doors of Monticello High School, knocks in and wants to get, saying, hey, they have XY student that they want to look at, whatever. Are they let into the building? What is the protocol?
So generally speaking, as it relates to law enforcement, there are really only three conditions that allow for a law enforcement, on-duty law enforcement official to either access a student or access their records. First, if there's some type of emergency that threatens the health and safety of either the school or the individual student or others in the school. Second, when the parent or caregiver has given permission to the law enforcement official to speak with their child. And third, if the law enforcement official presents an arrest warrant that says they are here to arrest a student and they identify that student. Those are generally the conditions where law enforcement is able to do that. Now, obviously, we have school resource officers and they provide all sorts of different services and instructional opportunities for our kids. And their roles and responsibilities are outlined in our district safety plan. But as it relates to your question around possible law and immigration enforcement action by, let's say, ICE or other officials, if they would operate under those same premises. In other words, if they came to our school, it depends on the order that they present to the, in this case, the principal, about how they're going to access either the student or the student's records. Again, if it's not one of those three conditions I spoke of, an emergency situation, permission from the parent or guardian, or an official arrest warrant from a judge, we will scrutinize with our attorneys what that document and order is calling for. I really can't get more specific than that because we haven't seen anything different than those, you know, kind of scenarios I described. And nationally, my understanding is that there has not yet been any enforcement action in public schools in the country. We're monitoring that carefully. And I think it all depends on if that were to start happening, we would see, you know, the type of paperwork that's being presented, and then we would plan accordingly.
Okay. Now, keep it on the national news there. The current administration is calling about a potential dismantling of the Department of Education. If the Department of Education were to be dismantled, the federal Department of Education would be dismantled. What immediate challenges do you foresee for the district?
That's difficult to say. As a public school district in New York, the agency that has the broadest and most direct authority over us is the New York State Education Department. The State Education Department, the commissioner, the Board of Regents really set the laws and regulations that, well, actually the legislature and the governor passed the laws, but the State Education Department really enforces them about how we are to operate as a school district in the state of New York. Really, our contact with the U.S. Department of Education over the years has been very limited, primarily in the former administration around issues of Title IX and equity, but also as it relates to federal funding. It's really the federal government sends money to the states for the state education agencies, which in our case is the State Education Department, to allocate and disperse those among public school districts. What that interplay might look like with either no department, U.S. Department of Education, or a reduced U.S. Department of Education and state education agencies, I can't tell. But really, I don't see any immediate effect in the short term if the role of the U.S. Department of Education were reduced. For us as a local school district.
Local school district. Because it really has to do with the, because I'm trying to understand it for myself. It will really have to do with the New York State Department of Education, because they get the federal funding and then they distribute out to the other local schools. Okay.
Yes. And the U.S. Department of Education wants assurances from the State Education Department that local school districts are abiding by regulations and laws. The U.S. Department of Education does, however, and I don't mean to diminish its role, does have a pretty significant influence in higher education,
right?
And higher education funding and scholarships and financial aid. It does play a larger role there, that I would say, than it does for K-12 schools.
Right. Dr. Evans, before we go, is there anything else we have not touched on you want folks to know about, either any of the topics that we discussed or anything that you would like to promote for the Monticello Central School District?
Yeah, thank you, Patricio, and thank you for having me. It's my pleasure. This time of year is budget season. Over the next several months, the Board of Education and Administration will be crafting and ultimately presenting to the community its annual budget. And I would just remind our community members and those people who live in other school districts that their local boards of ed are going through something similar at this time. I don't want to, with all of the other stuff that we just talked about, I want to make sure that our community members are aware that we are really focused on putting forward a budget that keeps in mind doing what we need to do for our students to make sure they leave us on the right foot and can be successful in their future careers, but also is mindful of the impact on the local taxpayers. So I would highlight that.
Sure. Any upcoming dates that the folks should know about? When it comes to the budget, any kind of like votes coming up or?
The budget will be adopted at our April 22nd, 2025 board meeting. And the annual budget hearing will be at our May 8th, 2025 Board of Education meeting. And then the budget vote in our district and all public school districts in New York State is on Tuesday, May 20th, 2025.
Dr. Evans, thank you so much for this. Do really appreciate it. We're talking to Dr. Matthew Evans, superintendent for the Monticello Central School District, talking about the potential cell phone ban, immigration, and the potential dismantling of the Department of Education and the upcoming budget votes. So thank you so much for talking to us. I do really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Patricio. Stay well.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Rovallo for Radio Catskill.
And we'll take a break. And when we come back, equine therapy in Northeast Pennsylvania. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org.
and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we're all about salt and ghosts. New York Times cooking columnist Melissa Clark gets into everything you need to know about fancy salts. And we have a fantastic new cookbook to tell you about called Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghosts. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Fair Hill Therapeutic Writing Center in Waymart, Pennsylvania specializes in therapeutic and adaptive writing, and the center is dedicated to providing a platform where participants can experience the unique benefits of connecting with horses in a judgment-free, supportive environment. Joining us now with more is Nancy Van Wyck, therapeutic writing instructor, mentor, and faculty member at the Fair Hill Therapeutic Writing Center. Nancy, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for being here. And thanks for bringing this to our attention. I was not aware there was an equine therapy a facility nearby. Tell us a little bit more about what makes this different from traditional forms of therapy and what makes the bond between humans and horses so powerful in a therapeutic setting.
So thank you. Yes, there's quite a bit that contributes to that. And ideally, what we start off with is that the equine is your partner in this process. And we say equine because it could be a horse, a donkey, you know, any variation thereof. Across the country, we have plenty of those. And we tell them that the equine is a sentient being, which it is, and they're able to process emotions, both yours and theirs. They're a prey animal, so they're highly attuned to their environment, and therefore they can read people very well.
And I think we're also now joined by Vera Reams, board of directors at Fair Hill, and she's also an equine assisted learning facilitator and equine specialist and a New Jersey certified teacher for handicapped and learning disability specialties. Hi, Vera.
Hi, Tim. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. We were just talking to Nancy about what makes the bond between humans and horses so powerful in these therapeutic settings. And in your experience, what are some of the most notable benefits you've observed in clients who participate in this type of learning, especially with mental health and emotional development?
Well, I work with Nancy, who's the mental health licensed practitioner, but the things that I see have to do with how it carries over into their family, but and also into their relationships with me and with everyone else that's involved in the process, the animals, the volunteers. In other words, you could see a total transformation with an individual. We work with ODD, which is oppositional defiant disorder, and to see children that are just naturally not wanting to do things, and then all of a sudden go operating, it's quite gratifying for us.
And to either of you, can you talk a little bit more about how individuals with learning disabilities or other special needs, in developing skills like focus and communication and social interaction, how are they helped by horses in this way?
Well, one of us, Vera, you go, Nancy, and then
which is how we usually do
taking
it.
Turns. Go ahead, Nancy.
Yeah. So the benefits are, because the equine, we want to make sure that the equine is a participant and not a novel item or a distraction, but because the equine is so large in its presence, we have things like heart math and grounding and breath work. All of this contributes to the physiological effect a human being feels just being in the presence of a horse. And there's quite a bit of a power dynamic there that when the person, the human, has settled themselves down and is being truly genuine and authentic in the experience, the horse minimizes the difference between that person and themselves. And that's a marker or a measurement that we can contribute to how that person is becoming more into their authentic self and being more aware of how others perceive them, and so on and so on.
And I can speak to the heart math, which maybe Ken doesn't know about. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but there is a heart variability rate that you can measure, and it's not your heartbeat, it's your the space between one beat and another. And the longer it takes, the calmer you feel, the easier you learn, the better you're able to do things. And when you're with a horse specifically, because they've actually measured this, the horse has a radius of about 30 feet, and everyone, and their heart is very slow. So anyone that comes within that 30-foot radius of that animal slows their heartbeat automatically. So it's one of the easy, and you can measure it. We have different things that you can. You can buy apps to measure it. People do it, and they work on it themselves without the horse. But seeing it with the animal, able to calm like an autistic child down who's having a rest day, shall we say, or even children with other disabilities or children without disabilities or adults without disabilities, watching them just touch a horse and seeing them melt. You visually see what is really just going on invisibly, and it's wonderful. And then they carry that on to other things that they do, school, home. Did I say that right, Nancy?
Yes.
Instead of any kind of... Sorry, we're getting a little motion on somebody's phone there. So a little bit of just instead of someone coming up to a horse and there's, being fearful, it actually helps slow the heart rate down, you're saying?
Yeah,
it does.
It should.
Right. Unless, of course, they have a phobia about horses.
As this type of therapy has become more mainstream, there might still be some people with misconceptions. What do you say to someone who's maybe skeptical about how working with a horse can help with the mental health or learning challenges?
Sure.
Look at the research.
Yes, exactly. So look at the measurements, do your own homework, and if they're feeling skeptical, please let the people, your practitioners, know that, and they'll certainly model something or give you more information or, work the program to where we do a lot with herd observation where they're not even close to the horse physically. We're on the other side of the fence, and you're seeing how the horses interact with each other, and that can often be a soft entry into seeing how this kind of starts to make sense.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Vera Reams and Nancy Van Wyk of Fair Hill Therapeutic Riding Center about the benefits of equine therapy. They're based in Waymart, Pennsylvania. Nancy, you work with veterans and their families as well. How do horses help the individuals process complex emotions that they may have experienced as a veteran, like grief or anxiety or PTSD, in a way that maybe traditional therapies might not?
Mm-hmm. Exactly, because oftentimes that population or that family dynamic has been what we call therapized. They've had enough of the face-to-face in the office type of interactions. And being out in a pastoral therapeutic environment itself, as Vera was starting to allude to, just being out in the atmosphere changes how you interpret things. And then put them with a horse who they may not know that horse being untethered, not having, a halter and lead rope on, is choosing to stand close to them or show an interest in them and not be speaking to them, not writing something down on their pad, right? So not saying, oh, that was a bad reaction. Oh, I'm going to write that down. The horse doesn't do that. The horse just kind of wants to know who you are and what's going on there. And listen, everyone wants to be seen and heard. And who best to do that than a 1,000-pound, four-legged partner?
And in your work with veterans, do you notice certain therapeutic breakthroughs or insights that are triggered with these interactions with the horses? And
Immensely. So, yeah. Right. When we set
Tell
up
us about those.
Like a peer-to-peer model, so we kind of go with teach one to reach one. So if we can take that person with a military history and offer them the opportunity to learn more things so that they can help others, because they're helpers. We're helpers. Both Vera and I have a law enforcement background, so we understand the dynamic that if we need help, well, who's going to help everybody? And that's kind of, you know, where their soul is with this work. So that's where we kind of go with that. We do that peer-to-peer model. That is usually where the breakthroughs come.
In your work, do the veterans talk to you about these moments that are particularly powerful for them? And what do they say? What has the feedback been?
Oh, I could go on for hours, and I won't. But I will tell you that, yes, just having someone, the biggest thing is someone not talking at them, withholding space for them, for not being on the clock, if you will, not having a diagnosis and something that they've got to write down and measure up against, just being. Can I just be? And the horse says, absolutely. What I do.
Excuse me, Vera, from your experience, would you say that that is also a benefit you see from clients who participate? Excuse me.
Absolutely, and it makes room for children of all ages to be able to learn more. I focus more on the learning, like the reading, the math, the life skills, and Nancy is a therapist, so what works for her helps me. So it's a symbiotic relationship that we have through the horses and through the people that we're serving. And we see things every day. It's quite amazing. And our director has she will not turn, I shouldn't really say this, she won't turn anyone away, you know, but like she just, for failure to be able to pay, she'll just go out. She's like a dog with a bone. If somebody needs a service, she goes out and finds funding for it, because that shouldn't be. If you need it, you get it, you know. So we're fortunate. I'll just say we had a child with ODG, oppositional defiance, overtones. I'm not going to say that he what his diagnosis was, but she went out and got funding so I could teach him reading using those parameters. So, you know, it was wonderful. We're still pulling teeth, but, you know, every day is better.
You also have unmounted or groundwork activities, meaning that, you know, folks don't necessarily have to get on the horse. How does that help folks gain some confidence?
Nancy?
From being on the ground and not doing work astride?
Yes.
So being on the ground, it takes that fear factor away, or that performance anxiety, like I need to know what I'm doing. And when you think about viewpoints, if you're sitting on the back of a horse, really your view is the back of the neck of the horse. But what most people want is a connection. They want to see that face, the eyes, the expression, and be able to make that connection with the horse. And if they don't see the face and feel like they're yanking around kind of on the back of the horse, that just, it takes away a lot of the opportunities to make those connections with their equine partner.
I also wanted to mention the history of Fair Hill. It was founded in 2007 by the family of Art Goldberg. Art had symptoms related to multiple sclerosis. His son, Ben, was an advanced therapeutic riding instructor and helped develop the farm. The farm ended up closing after during COVID. You guys, with a lot of hard work, have reopened under a new structure. Vera, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, the new structure is that we're going whole hog from therapeutic riding over to equine assisted services to really broaden the scope of therapeutic riding. The title is Fair Hill Therapeutic Riding Center, but it's so much more. It isn't just riding, and it isn't just therapeutic. And Nancy can talk about the difference, but it's also can be therapy. There's a big difference between both of that. Therapy is the more, would you call it medical type of thing that Nancy would do. And I do the therapeutic part, which is using it more for life skills and actually for academic skills. So I think we're ready for a name change. Equine assisted services, something like that.
Breaking news.
Yeah, right. You're the first to hear.
So if folks want to learn more, I mean, you have participants, but you also welcome volunteers. And if they want to learn more about Fair Hill, tell us more where they can go and what they can do.
Well, we have a large presence on social media. So we've got a very active Facebook page. We're updating the website. We just had a meeting Tuesday night about that, but it's active. And the response rate is phenomenal. If you don't hear back from somebody an hour, then you need to go see what's going on outside. They may be in the barn.
That's right.
Yes. We do. We have a lot of people that jump on those messages real quickly.
And there's also a website, fairhill.farm, where you can get more information and find out more about your mission.
And we do have two different sites that we go to, one in Damascus and one in, is it Waymart? Nancy goes to Waymart more than I do, right?
Yes.
You've got Northeast PA covered
there. And I'm in Damascus, yeah. So we cover a big area.
Well, thank you both so much. We've been talking to Vera Reams from the Board of Directors at Fair Hill and Nancy Van Wyck, Therapeutic Writing Instructor, Mentor, and faculty member at Fair Hill Therapeutic Writing Center, which may undergo a name change. You heard it here first. Thank you guys so much for...
It'll be a surprise to Sally, but
Thank you guys so much for joining us and for all you're doing to connect folks with these horses and, provide that support.
You betcha. Okay, thank you for your time.
All right, we'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll get some more information about a book giveaway for elementary school students in Liberty. This is Radio Chatskill.
This is Ira Glass. On This American Life, sometimes we just show up somewhere, turn on our tape recorders, and see what happens.
If you can't get 7 cars in 12 days, you got to look yourself in the mirror and say, holy, what are you kidding me?
Like at this car dealership, trying to sell its monthly quota of cars, and it is not going well.
I just don't want one balloon to a car. Balloon the whole freaking place so it looks like a circus.
Real life stories every week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The All Things Liberty Winter Festival is taking place on February 22nd at the Liberty High School gym with carnival games, craft vendors, karaoke, and more that you might expect at a winter festival like that. But this year, there's a special edition. The Liberty Faculty Association is hosting a book giveaway for Liberty elementary students made possible through a grant from the American Federation of Teachers. The giveaway will feature a variety of books, including Spanish language titles, bilingual editions, and books for different reading levels. Patricia Rubio recently spoke with Jill Parks, the middle school librarian at Liberty Central School District, about the giveaway and its positive impact on the community.
The president of our union, Kevin Ferguson, approached me about the idea. He had read about this grant called Reading Opens the World through the American Federation of Teachers. And that grant, the American Federation of Teachers works with an organization called First Book. And First Book is an organization that helps educators and others get books that are free or at low cost for teachers and educators to give away to their students.
Now, being a librarian, I am sure you know how important it is for students to read, but also to get them reading at a young age. Can you talk more about that? Absolutely. As why is it so important for kids to have access to books? And also to maybe want to explain also why are you having also books in bilingual?
Sure. We have a large population of students here who are learning English and most speak Spanish. So it's important for them to have books that they feel that they can identify with and connect with in their own language, as well as books that will help them learn English. And access to books in general is very important, because when students have more access to books, when the access to books is increased, then their imagination and creativity is increased. Family bonding is increased, as well as the lifelong love of reading is learned and enforced, and it also adds up to educational success, because there is a link between reading and overall academic achievement. We know, studies show, that children who are read to more often have improved language and listening skills, and they also experience stronger emotional connections with their loved ones and gain a lifelong love of reading. Children who read for pleasure are more likely to do well in school and have a wider vocabulary and just have a better understanding of the world around them. So this is super important.
Yeah. But your experience as the librarian, what are some of the biggest challenges in getting kids excited about reading?
The biggest challenge these days is competing with their electronic devices and competing with the visual media that they are so in tune to. Experiencing books and reading at a young age, getting them started as young as possible, loving books fosters that lifelong hobby and habit.
And I say the book giveaway is happening at the Liberty Winter Festival. If you could talk a little bit about the also Winter Festival, because I'm interested, because this is going to be held at the gym. I'm interested in where the sled riding is going to happen.
Oh, we have a hill outside in the back, and right now it looks like there's going to be snow as long as the forecast holds out. Yep, there's a big hill in the back that sometimes the students will take tubes out there during phys ed when there's snow and ride down that hill. So that's where that'll be.
That's awesome. Now, if those who don't live within the central school district, they can still attend, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, we have about 1,000 books that we're looking to give away. As you mentioned, some will be bilingual. We also have biographies on people such as Taylor Swift, Kobe Bryant, Simone Biles, Muhammad Ali. And there'll be a lot of student favorite books like Magic Treehouse and Diary of a Wimpy Kid.
Diary of a Wimpy Kid, which I think is the same author as Dog Man, which is one of my daughter's favorite books.
Yeah. So that's real popular now with the movie out.
Yeah, it certainly is. So what are sort of the age ranges? You're sticking to middle school, or it goes young first grade?
Picture books through early chapter books, so up to fifth, sixth grade.
If those who are listening, and you said some things already, but how can families or caretakers that are listening, what are some of the simple ways that they can foster a love of reading at home?
The best ways are to have books in the house so that your children can always get their hands on a book. Also, visiting your local library. Libraries are so important for access to free information and books for students, as well as programs where children can go and be read to at the library. Another important thing for fostering reading early is for your children to see their parents enjoying reading as well.
So the Liberty Winter Festival is happening on February 22nd from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Liberty High School gym. Also, will be a book giveaway happening at the same time, hosted by the Liberty Faculty Association. Jill, before we go, is there anything else that we should know about the festival or just about having young kids getting to reading?
I think the last thing I would like to leave you with is that reading to children is especially important to helping them develop empathy, learning about different cultures, and understanding different perspectives.
We're talking to Jill Parks, middle school librarian for the Liberty Central School District, talking about the Winter Festival that's coming up and the book giveaway. Jill, thank you so much for joining us on the program. Do really appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Catskill.
And a quick break for us when we come back. Information about a generative writing workshop open to writers of all levels this weekend. This is Radio Catskill.
For the next jazz night in America, we introduce you to Isaiah J. Thompson, a rising star of the piano, making waves in the world of jazz. That's next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride. Join me Sunday at 8 here on Radio Catskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, we go back to Toñita's social club because these days, Bad Bunny is hanging out there. That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Teresa Tolopano is an interdisciplinary artist and writer who will be sharing her expertise with a writing workshop at One Grand Books in Narrowsburg, New York this weekend. Cultural reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to Tolopano about that workshop called New Year, New Writing, a generative workshop for all writers of all levels.
Good morning, Teresa, and welcome to Radio Catskill.
Good morning, Valerie. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm excited to have you here to talk about a workshop that you're going to be giving at One Grand Books in Narrowsburg on Sunday, February 16th. From 3 to 5 p.m., and it is New Year, New Writing, and it is a generative writing class. What is that?
So it's a class that will help people generate new ideas and new writing, and I like to say that it works across all genres and kind of for all levels of writer. So it can be used as a clinic if you're in the middle of writing something that you're stuck in, or you can use it to create brand new ideas that you will write to either finish it in the class or take it home with you and continue to write it there. But it's about giving yourself new ways to approach the blank page.
Which is a constant problem for writers, so I hear.
Yes, this is the most common thing that I hear. I often get asked to help out people with their writing. I do one-on-one private coaching for writing, and people get stuck or they can't think of what to write. And I have developed over many years a lot of techniques on how to approach the writing and how to start, you know, your creative process if you're stuck.
How many of these workshops have you given in the past?
Oh, I've taught dozens of classes, not always a generative writing workshop. I often teach around the Catskills these, I like to call them pop culture writing classes.
Uh-huh, what is that?
Yeah, I take a singer or a band, some kind of musical artist, and we dress like the musician. We show up and listen to songs by the musician. We dance and sing together. And then in between songs, I give writing prompts based on something about the song that we've listened to.
So they're really fun. I've done a Stevie Nicks one that was incredibly fun over at All Sorts in Hancock. Aaron Hicklin, who owns One Grand Books, and I did one of them. I taught one about David Bowie, and that was in Woodstock. I also have hopefully some coming up. I don't want to jinx it, but I've got a bunch of artists that I'd like to work with, anywhere from the Rolling Stones to Taylor Swift to Prince. So bands that people like and enjoy. And it's been kind of a fun thing to strike upon. I really enjoy doing it.
And how does it relate to writing?
So in between these songs, I give people writing prompts based on the songs that we've listened to together.
What fun!
Yeah, they tend to be extremely fun classes.
Because, you know, when you think of writing and how difficult it could be at times and how difficult even a workshop can be, this sounds like a very refreshing approach.
Well, you know, in my own life, I have done a lot of performance art and including performing in kind of cabaret shows and stuff back in the day in San Francisco. I performed in drag shows when I was in my 20s. And I have a real love of dressing up. So that was part of the inspiration for me. In the Stevie Nicks class, for example, I required that everybody had to bring a shawl because Stevie always wears like a lace shawl. And we use that to inform our dance moves together. And it was really fun. I have to say, Valerie, you're going to have to come to one of these one day.
I'm going to make sure I do. You've whetted my appetite for sure. Get dressed up and dance and have a good time.
Yeah.
What's not to like? So what kinds of exercises, if you call them that, I'm not sure that that's the
sure.
right word.
You know, I'd like to save them for the class.
Okay.
They are kind of proprietary to the class. If I
Got
give
it.
Them on the radio, they're
yeah.
not going to
yeah.
maybe sign up for
okay.
the class. But
Good.
I will say that I have, you know, I've been really fortunate in my life to work with some great writers. And I was predominantly a poet in my earlier life. I also wrote for a newspaper in San Francisco, and I got to work with some incredible writers. So I worked with Bob Haas, who was the poet laureate of the U.S. at that time, Sharon Olds, the great Lucille Clifton,
yes.
rest in peace, the great Galway Connell, rest in peace, Marie Howe, and I was fortunate enough to work with all of those people I just mentioned at, it was formerly called the Squaw Valley Community of Writers. Now it's just the Community of Writers. And their techniques for creating new work were really an inspiration for me. And I was lucky, I was in my 20s, so I got to sort of form my ideas about how to conduct writing workshops from that experience and from those truly great writers. So what I can say about my classes is that they're always a supportive and safe space. The Squaw Valley way was to not give any negative criticism at all. In the entire, we spent a week together, 60 poets in the mountains in Northern California, and we were only allowed to talk about what we loved in each other's work, which created this really supportive environment that allowed people to write, you know, things that they might not have ever written because they felt so safe to try new things and experiment. So that's my foundation. And I believe strongly that you can get the best out of people by giving them positive feedback.
Are there times that a critique is necessary?
Yes, I do believe in that. I think that's more suited to a different type of class than I'm going to do at One Grand. That's for more advanced writers you know, the one grand class coming up, new year, new writing, is for writers of any level. But if people are a bit more advanced, or in my one-on-one work with writers, I definitely give critical feedback. But I do it still in a gentle manner. I think, often criticism is, just like too harsh, and harshness kills creativity. So we're coming together to support creativity and to encourage it.
That is a wonderful position to have, I must say, Teresa. how would folks find out more about you and the various classes you're giving or events you're participating in?
Well, I can be followed on Instagram. My handle there is @SageNYC, which is spelled SageNYC. Or you can find me, you know, I pop up around town, but I am really frequently a participant in the Yarn Slingers. So if you are somebody who follows the Yarn Slingers, or if you're on their mailing list, Greg Triggs, who is our executive director, is so generous about sharing out the information on classes and anything that any of the Yarn Slinger storytellers are doing. He typically sends out an email to our distribution list, so you could go to yarnslingers.com and sign up to be on that distro list. That's a pretty solid way to hear about stuff I'm doing in the future.
Wonderful. And let's go over the event again and how to RSVP, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure thing. So it's going to be coming up on Sunday the 16th from 3 to 5 p.m. at One Grand Books in Narrowsburg. I'm sure your listeners know where that is, but just in case, the address, I believe, is, yes, it's 60 Main Street in Narrowsburg. And it's just across from DVAA. And if you are interested in signing up for this class, you can email rsvp@onegrandbooks.com, and you will be sent a sign-up link for it.
Well, thank you so much, Teresa, for offering this wonderful event to our community.
Oh, it's really my pleasure. I am a big fan of Aaron Hicklin and his shop, and I was delighted to be invited to teach there.
Oh, yes, he is full of generosity.
Well, and a talented writer.
Well, thank you again, Teresa, and I look forward to speaking with you again.
Thank you, Valerie. Thank you so much. This was really nice of you to have me on your show.
You are welcome.
Thanks to Valerie Manzi, speaking to Teresa Tilipano. That'll about do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A note, because of today's weather, the Livingston Manor Roscoe vote scheduled for tonight has been postponed a week. Residents will be electing their new merged district school board now next Thursday, February 20th, from noon to 8 in the Livingston Manor gym. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association, SullivanCatskills.com, Catskill Brewery, brewing ales, lagers, and mixed fermentation beers in a LEED Gold certified building, plus a food truck and beer garden at Exit 96 off Route 17 in Livingston Manor, CatskillBrewery.com, and listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Donna Fellenberg here, host of Catskill Character. My guest this week is Janice Noble of Narrowsburg, New York. Janice is an artist, a fabulous cook, and a ubiquitous presence in and around Narrowsburg. Originally from St. Kitts and Nevis, Janice has made the U.S. her home since 2007, and we're the better for it. Tune in Saturday at 10:30 to Catskill Character for my conversation with Janice Noble.
It's Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. today's weather, some intermittent light rain continuing, then windy and cloudy this afternoon. Wind gusts over 40 miles an hour could be possible, a high of 37. Cloudy tonight, a few flurries or snow showers possible with a low of 17. Tomorrow, clouds and sunshine mixed with a high of 23. Still could be windy with some gusts over 40 miles an hour. And on Saturday, we're watching a potential winter storm. Again, snow is likely. We could see 3 to 5 inches during the day and a high of 24. An additional 1 to 3 inches of snow and ice expected on Saturday night.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.